From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the civil rights movement through the eyes of one of its foremost lawyers. We talk with Jack Greenberg about his 35 years with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He succeeded his mentor, Thurgood Marshall, as the group's director. Greenberg's new memoir, Crusaders in the Courts, chronicles many of the movement's greatest legal victories and defeats. Also today, the new gold rush. Gold mining is behind the latest controversy over the use of America's public lands. It's the subject of a PBS Frontline documentary tonight. We'll talk to correspondent Robert Krolwich. And commentator Jim Northrop tells us why his reservation needs to enter the computer age. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A Muslim fundamentalist is arguing his case before a federal judge in New York before being sentenced by that judge for the World Trade Center bombing. He can't feel encouraged by the sentences handed out before him. His three co-defendants each received 240 years in prison. Judge Kevin Duffy called them sneaks and cowards. He said he wanted their sentences to reflect the years that have been taken from the six people who died in the bombing. South African President Nelson Mandela today pledged to create what he called a society of liberty as he addressed the new national parliament chosen in last month's all-race election. In his State of the Nation speech, Mandela also promoted his country as a sound trading partner for foreign investors. More from NPR's Ann Cooper.
2 weeks after his euphoric inauguration as South Africa's first post-apartheid president, Nelson Mandela offered a speech pitched more at outside investors than at the apartheid victims who voted for him. He promised fiscal discipline and a fair trade policy, and he repeated his position that new social programs to build houses and schools for apartheid's victims could be financed by redirecting the country's existing budget. Skeptics say that Mandela cannot deliver on these promises without new taxes, but for now at least, members of his coalition cabinet, which includes representatives of the former white minority government, have united behind the new president's economic and social programs. I'm Ann Cooper in Cape Town.
The U.S. and Japan today reached agreement on how to talk about a trade agreement. Negotiations on opening Japanese markets to more U.S. goods had been suspended 3 months ago. As many as a million and a half people have had to flee their homes in Rwanda and remain homeless inside their country. The significance of that is that refugees who don't cross into other countries are not entitled to international protection. The statistic came to light in a report issued today by the U.S. Committee for Refugees. Director Roger Winter says the Rwandan refugees are just a small part of the problem.
Out of the 25 million internally displaced people we reflect in the World Refugee Survey, 17 million of them are in Africa. And many of the conflicts that are spawning those people are very evident, but the most recent numbers, such as from Rwanda, are not even in the totals because the numbers are as of December 31.
Winter says many of the Rwandan refugees are badly wounded, attacked with machetes, screwdrivers, saws, and hammers. On Wall Street this hour, the Dow is up 7.36 points at 3749.77 in heavy trading of 272 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ Composite Index is also up 5.99 points at 730.94. This is National Public Radio News. The Justice Department announced today a record settlement of a racial discrimination case. The Denny's restaurant chain has agreed to pay nearly $46 million to end claims that it denied service to black patrons. Denny's will also put in place a nationwide program to prevent discrimination in the future. Justice Department officials said this is the most sweeping settlement and the largest number of dollars settled in a case alleging racial discrimination by a business open to the public. Prosecutors in Italy have decided to try 32 leading politicians and managers on charges of corruption. The case involves the payment of bribes and illegal contributions to political parties. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
The list of those to go on trial on July 5th reads like a who's who of Italy's now disgraced political class. led by the former prime ministers Bettino Craxi and Arnaldo Forlani. But there's also Umberto Bossi, the head of the Northern League, which is part of the right-wing coalition government elected 2 months ago. The charges concern alleged payments of bribes by the agrochemicals group Ferruzzi before the 1992 general elections. One of the accused, the former socialist prime minister Bettino Craxi, is currently at his luxury villa in Tunisia, where he's said to be undergoing treatment for diabetes. He recently sent a sick note to magistrates in Milan who asked him to hand in his passport. However, the note did not say he was unfit to travel, so the judges expect him to return for the trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
One of the more interesting aspects of the story about the American caned in Singapore for vandalism was the public reaction. Not only were many people not shocked and horrified, many applauded the punishment. Now, out of California, there's a proposal to impose a milder form of Singapore justice. Two state lawmakers have introduced a measure to require graffiti artists to be paddled. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of the early civil rights battles were fought in the courts. My guest Jack Greenberg helped fight them. For 23 years, he directed the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He succeeded his mentor, Thurgood Marshall, under whom Greenberg had worked for 12 years. The LDF won the Brown v. Board of Education case that desegregated the schools. It defended the work of Martin Luther King and won him the right to march from Selma to Montgomery. It defended movement sit-ins, freedom rides, and other protests, and helped bring about the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It also helped build the foundation of affirmative action law. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund was created in 1939 and split from the NAACP in 1957, although it retained the name. Jack Greenberg has written a memoir called Crusaders in the Courts. I asked him why the courts were so important in the early days of the movement.
Blacks couldn't vote in the South. They were kept out of the Democratic primary, which was the only election that really counted in the South. The Legal Defense Fund in 1944 won some cases called the white primary cases, but Southern states engaged in all kinds of stratagems to keep blacks out. So there was absolutely no political power. It was impossible even to pass an anti-lynching bill. There was talk about armed revolution, but that would be suicidal. And so the only place to turn was the courts. And black lawyers, led by a man who only could be called a genius, Charles Hamilton Houston, who then recruited Thurgood Marshall, who had been a student of his at Howard Law School, began a campaign which led to Brown against Board of Education.
Last week was the anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision that overturned legalized segregation in the schools. You worked on that case. How did you decide to take on Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court decision which upheld legalized segregation?
Well, you had to do that. If you didn't overrule Plessy against Ferguson, then segregation would be constitutional and legal throughout the United States. That case was decided in 1896 and said the states might segregate at will. And all the southern states and some northern states and cities did as well. So unless you overruled Plessy against Ferguson, you would be like South Africa with apartheid before the release of Mandela. We had to do that.
But why did you wait that long to do it then?
Well, the campaign actually started in the 30s. It was only in the 30s that there was the resources. There was money which they obtained from a foundation called the American Fund for Public Service. A young man called Charles Garland had inherited $1 million, and that was in the days when $1 million was $1 million, and he decided to devote that to good causes, and he gave a lot of money to civil rights, and that was used to launch the campaign. There were also virtually no black lawyers in the country. Even when I began practicing in 1949, in some states there was only one single solitary black lawyer, hard to believe, only one in Delaware, one in Alabama, and one in Louisiana. And other states had two or three, and North Carolina had a dozen. So there weren't the resources, there weren't the lawyers. There was no conception of how to go about doing it. That all began to develop around the 30s and came to fruition in the late 40s.
When you took on Brown versus the Board of Ed, did you have a sense of what the risks would be if you lost?
We felt that if we lost, it would be a catastrophe, that segregation would be embedded into American life for a long, long time, a generation at least, maybe several generations. We had no idea of what would happen if we won. We knew that it would be better. We knew there would be some integration. We knew it would be a long struggle. Thurgood at one point said in a conference, and I've set this forth in the book, that in the state of Georgia we would have to go county by county, and there are 100 counties in Georgia, and that was true of all the southern states.
Were you afraid you would lose?
No, we never anticipated that we would lose. It's not that we knew we would win. We just went ahead on the assumption we would win. It was like being in the Second World War where I fought. You just went ahead and did what you had to do, and you had faith. I don't mean an act of energetic faith, but just an assumption that you would win.
What was the main legal argument you built the case on?
We used a spectrum of arguments. We used a whole series of arguments. We argued first at the most primitive level that black schools were inferior to white schools in their physical facilities. The black schools were often tar paper shacks and had hand-me-down books and outhouses, and this was quite common throughout the South. And so because the schools were unequal, black kids had to be admitted to the white schools. And actually, on that basis, I won one of the five school segregation cases in the trial court in Delaware. So that was a viable theory, but that would not have struck down segregation forever because theoretically they could equalize the schools or claim they were equal and they could go segregate again or continue to segregate where they'd done that. We claimed also that since schools' inequality of the kind I've just described was so pervasive, and that always accompanied segregation, reaching for an old doctrine that I won't bother to describe to you in any detail now, that if segregation is always accompanied by inequality, then the segregation is unconstitutional. So that was another argument we made. And then the argument that ended up being cited by the Supreme Court was that because segregation stigmatized black children and interfered with their ability to learn and to develop relationships which were important in the educational process and in life, segregation was per se an inequality. And so we used that whole broad range of doctrine.
Do you feel that in some ways the schools now, the public schools, are as segregated as ever?
No, not at all. Throughout the South, the rural and small town South is very highly desegregated. Some of the big cities in the South are desegregated as well. The major cities of the North, like New York and Chicago, remain essentially segregated. White people live in the suburbs, and the Supreme Court has adopted a doctrine which makes it difficult, though not impossible, to desegregate against the school across school district lines.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Greenberg, and from 1961 to 84, he was director and counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He's written a new memoir called Crusaders in the Courts. You write that you didn't realize it at the time, but Brown versus Board of Education marked the end of the phase of the civil rights movement where all the important victories were won in court. Why was that the end of that period?
Because while we continued to win important victories in court, a whole new phenomenon emerged, and that was known as the civil rights movement. In 1960, February 1, 1960, a date easy to remember, four black students sat in at a Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, and they refused to move unless they would be served. And that spread like wildfire all over the South. Then freedom rides began, that is, black people began sitting in the front of the bus where they weren't supposed to. And then Martin Luther King, who by then was a national figure, became even more prominent, leading marches in Birmingham and from Selma to Montgomery and elsewhere. And thousands and thousands of people, maybe tens of thousands, were involved in the movement. And our legal practice then changed so that we had to represent them, and we represented them in thousands of cases, and we won virtually every single case.
So your work was led by the people who were leading the demonstrations. You weren't initiating what the court actions
that
were going
that's
to be.
Right. Leading up to the decision in Brown, we plotted, we planned. If we took a case and it wasn't turning out right, we would drop it and take another one. We would shape the facts and pick and choose and so forth. But a bunch of kids wanted to sit in. They didn't consult us in advance. They just sat in, and we had to represent them. We didn't have to, but we felt there was a moral obligation, and there was an obligation for the movement to represent them, and we did.
I think one of the typical problems you faced was when 300 freedom riders were arrested in Jackson, they were all going to be tried separately. So you'd have like 300 of virtually the same trial on your hands, and you tried to get the courts to represent them in what?
Well, I
to allow you to represent them in one suit.
I asked the Attorney General of Mississippi, would he agree to the two or three typical test cases, and the mm-hmm. others would, because I knew we would win. And he said, talk to the local lawyer. And I spoke to the local lawyer, and the local lawyer, using a phrase that's used out on the farm, said, I just got on this tit. Don't try to knock me off it.
Hmm. So you had to do 300 separately?
328 cases separately. We ended up winning them all, but they took, you know, a long, long time, several years.
A lot of the civil rights movement was based on civil disobedience, intentionally breaking laws that were perceived to be unjust. As a lawyer yourself, as somebody who worked within the legal system, how did you feel about civil disobedience?
Well, it was my position that if someone was breaking a civil rights law, a segregation law, that was not civil disobedience, because that law was really not a law. It was unconstitutional. So I didn't call that civil disobedience, even though people frequently did. Martin Luther King himself said he was engaged in civil disobedience. Usually he wasn't. He was violating a law that was unconstitutional. If someone deliberately went and lay down in the middle of the street to stop traffic, that would be civil disobedience. So we didn't handle cases like that because someone was violating the law deliberately, and Martin Luther King's position on that was that part of the civil disobedience was that you should accept punishment as well. And that was his position, and that was our position.
What impact did it have on you when some civil rights groups wanted to be more completely black identified and didn't want any white people functioning as leaders within the group?
That, of course, was never true at the Legal Defense Fund. I thought that was a serious mistake, and indeed it turned out to be, because the groups which became totally separatist, like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and CORE, and the Black Panthers, of course, which were separatist from the very beginning, pretty much faded. They didn't get support from black people. They got some, but they didn't get enough to sustain themselves. And, of course, they'd excluded white people, and so they faded. So I thought it was a serious mistake, and I thought it was contrary to the ethos of what the movement was supposed to accomplish.
My guest is Jack Greenberg. He was director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund from 1961 to 1984. He's written a new memoir called Crusaders in the Courts. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jack Greenberg, former director of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. You left the Legal Defense Fund in, I think it was 1984.
That's right.
And you had, I believe, already started teaching by then. And in the early 80s, you were supposed to teach a Harvard Law School course on anti-discrimination law. And you were to co-teach it with a black attorney, Julius Chambers, who was also with the Legal Defense Fund. But your course was boycotted by the Harvard Black Law Students Association and a group called the Third World Coalition. They were opposed to a white person teaching this course, and they were also taking a stand against Harvard for failing to hire more African-American professors. What was your reaction to this protest against you teaching a course on discrimination in the courts?
Well, first of all, we went ahead and we taught the course. They picketed us for a day or two, and then they went away.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was sadly mistaken. What's interesting is that a number of students came by and visited me in my office individually or in small groups and said that they disagreed with the boycott. And I said, well, then why don't you take the course? And they said they could not break ranks with the Black Students Organization. And that taught me a lesson, because I think it's important for people who disagree with that kind of separatist thinking and racist thinking to speak out, so that students who are too timid to take a position can have someone that they can adhere to rather than have to just agree with the separatist group and go along a path that they disagree with.
You had an op-ed piece in the New York Times just yesterday.
That's right.
About the alignment between African-American groups like the NAACP and the Nation of Islam, an alliance which you found very discouraging. Do you think that the NAACP should completely cut itself off from the Nation of Islam?
No, but I think it should not align itself with not merely the Nation of Islam, but it is there was Leonard Jeffries and Nation of Islam and Sister Souljah and a group of others who have in common Islamic religious beliefs, which are fine, but have in common hatred or exclusion of white people. And I think the civil rights movement prospered during the days when it was an interracial alliance. And as I said a moment ago, organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and CORE and the Black Panthers, when they became separatist, all faded from view. And I think the only way you can really advance the civil rights agenda is by a broad interracial alliance and not chasing away Catholics and women and engaging in homophobia and misogyny and anti-Semitism.
You worked with Thurgood Marshall at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund when you were a young man just getting out of law school. Then you ended up succeeding Marshall as the head of the Legal Defense Fund when he left for the Supreme Court. And I wonder what kind of mentor he was, what some of the basic principles were that you learned from him.
Well, I learned from him to be very professional. He was not one of these lawyers who yelled and screamed and carried on and waved his arms. He would talk about that kind of lawyer who would put on a big show in the courtroom, and then he said as his client was dragged off to the electric chair, he would say, boy, my lawyer sure gave him hell. He had respect for institutions. When he argued a case, you never heard people say yes, sir, and no, sir, and may it please the court as often as he did. Again, unlike a lot of flamboyant lawyers you hear and see and hear about today, he was very professional in the sense that all the work had to be done neatly. It had to look good. He told the story of that once when he was a law student, he had a job working for a black lawyer in town and carried a brief to the local clerk's office. And the brief was smudged and wrinkled and so forth. And the local lawyer, the clerk of the court referred to it as a nigger brief. And Thurgood said nobody in his office would file a nigger brief. And he also knew how to take advice. He would confer regularly with people from law firms, law schools, universities, scholars of all sorts, and talk and confer and hash things out and ultimately synthesize a position. So I learned how to do all of those things.
What was it like to travel with him in the South when the South was still legally segregated?
Well, we couldn't go to any restaurant. Before 1950, there was a brief time I was there, in the late 1950, blacks had to be in separate railroad cars or just couldn't eat in the diner on a railroad train. We couldn't stay in hotels. I guess I could, but I certainly wouldn't do that. It was worse in South Africa. Now, in one instance, a case that we were in Florida, tensions in the community ran so high because there was a charge of rape against a black man that it was impossible for me to stay in a black home where I usually stayed. They didn't want to have a white person seen going in and out, so I stayed in a white hotel, and he came up to my room in those circumstances. But generally speaking, we stayed in people's homes.
What kind of attitude did you see him have about having to obey these laws that he knew were unjust, that were demeaning?
He's
a man of the law.
He obeyed those laws. He, as he said, when he went south, he wrapped his civil rights in cellophane and put them in his pocket. It's a term he used. Sometimes he would joke and say, I have a big yellow streak down my back. But he did not defy those laws. He didn't sit in the part of the bus or the train where he wasn't supposed to. He didn't march into a lunch counter and demonstrate. He just swallowed his pride and obeyed the local law and went about doing what he had to do as a lawyer to strike those laws down, in which he ultimately was successful.
How did he feel about the people who later did break the law?
As far as the sit-in demonstrators and so forth, we convinced ourselves that they had good defenses, and we defended them. Though he really explored that and thoroughly took those issues apart and wanted to be absolutely certain before we went ahead and did it. Actually, he was out of the country. He was in England working on the Kenyan constitution. Kenya was about to become independent then, and I was in the office, and he'd left me in charge, and I resolved to take the cases when he wasn't there, and he came back, and he took that whole thing apart and examined it very, very carefully and then decided, yes, we'd go ahead and defend them. But he just didn't accept it just offhand or just because I'd done it.
What were his reservations?
Well, it certainly looked from the outset as if they'd broken the law, didn't it? It looked as if they were trespassing or engaged in breach of the peace or whatever you want to call it. On closer examination, it was clear that to arrest and prosecute them because they were sitting there because of their race was the enforcement of racial segregation by the police and the whole judicial system and so forth, and that the prosecutions were unconstitutional. But that wasn't apparent at first glance.
I want to go back to something we were talking about earlier, and this is the whole blacks and Jews thing.
Yes.
I think you've said that from your vantage point, you started to see some friction between certain black groups and certain Jewish groups at about the time of affirmative action, when some Jewish groups opposed affirmative action, which you supported and worked on behalf of.
That's right. I thought that was a serious mistake, and I called them and I spoke to them, and I said, look, this is not affecting Jews adversely. It's crucial for the black community. It's helping create a black middle class. They disagreed with me. They ultimately came to agree. You now don't find Jewish groups opposing affirmative action, certainly not actively. They might give a little. Certainly, most of them are not opposing it at all. Some are saying, well, we disagree with it in principle or so, but they're not actively, aggressively opposing it.
There was a cocktail party in which a woman came up to you and said, because of you, my son
didn't get into Harvard. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, my son didn't get into Harvard.
She poked her finger right into my chest. I almost spilled my drink. That's right.
So what did you say to her and probably all the other parents who said the same thing to you?
I said to her, where did he go? She said, to Haverford. I said, well, you know, in some ways that's better. It's not exactly as if he was out on the street and didn't go to college. And anyway, there's no reason to believe he would have gotten to Harvard if they had not taken some black student. I mean, that's just preposterous. He didn't go because maybe they took the child of an alumnus, or they took a war veteran, or they took an athlete, you know. Why blame it on the black?
Did you hear that a lot?
I don't hear that anymore, no. People are just like school desegregation and busing. It's not very controversial any longer. You hear a little bit about it. You don't hear a lot about affirmative action.
As a white person from the North, from the Bronx specifically, were you comfortable in black communities in the South, or did it feel at all foreign to you, like a really different culture than the one you were used to?
No, I just I felt like I really belonged. I did not feel uncomfortable in the slightest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I made you know, the best friends of my life, and I think they view it the same way I did.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my great pleasure to have spoken with you.
Jack Greenberg is the former director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He's now a professor at Columbia Law School. His new memoir is called Crusaders in the Courts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the new gold rush on America's public lands. We talk with journalist Robert Krolwich about the efforts to reform a 120-year-old mining law that has the Clinton administration and Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt pitted against the mining industry and its supporters in Congress. It's the subject of Krolwich's new Frontline documentary, Public Lands, Private Profits. Also, online on the reservation, commentator Jim Northrup reflects on how computers could change the way they do things on his Chippewa reservation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The United States and Japan have agreed to restart talks on opening up Japanese markets to foreign goods. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Representative Mickey Cantor announced the resumption of talks today at the White House. The new agreement essentially restates the ground rules of the talks that collapsed earlier this year, but it clarifies one of the biggest sticking points between Japan and the U.S. in order to quell Japanese fears about the administration's approach of results-oriented trade talks. Japan worries that the U.S. insistence on objective targets for specific market sectors would result in quotas and sanctions. Mickey Cantor said the U.S. made it clear it was not seeking numerical targets as the sole measure of progress in U.S.-Japanese trade.
We have said it continually since July 3rd of 1993, again and again, we're not seeking numerical targets or managed trade.
Instead, Cantor said the number of foreign products sold in Japan will be just one of a set of criteria used to measure progress in opening markets. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A federal judge in New York has sentenced three of those convicted in the bombing of the World Trade Center to 240 years in prison, saying he wanted to be sure they died in prison. A fourth defendant is to be sentenced momentarily. U.S. District Judge Kevin Duffy said he calculated the time by adding up the life expectancies of the six who were killed by the bombers, 180 years, and then adding another 30 years each on two other counts. Eyewitness accounts put the death toll at more than 200 after a stampede during the annual pilgrimage by Muslims to the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Government officials in Saudi Arabia have yet to give details of the incident. Edward Uranian reports from Beirut.
Pilgrims had gathered in droves on the outskirts of Mecca. They had come to cast stones in a symbolic gesture denouncing the devil. There was a colossal stampede, said one eyewitness. I saw very panicky people coming back from the area. One reporter from an Indonesian newspaper claimed to have seen up to 20 piles containing at least a dozen bodies. A tersely worded Saudi Arabian press report put the death toll during the entire pilgrimage at 829. It cited old age, heart failure, and intense crowding as the chief causes of death. No mention was made of the stampede. More than 1,800 people were killed in 1990 following another stampede in a crowded pedestrian tunnel. For National Public Radio, this is Edward Uranian in Beirut.
Denny's Restaurants has agreed to pay a record settlement of more than $45 million to settle race discrimination lawsuits. Stock prices closed slightly higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 3 points to close at 3745.17. Advances led declines by 4-3 in heavy trading of 280 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. The new president of South Africa made his first State of the Nation speech today. Nelson Mandela called for reconciliation among the various peoples of South Africa after decades of racial discrimination and strife. Mandela promised help for the impoverished blacks in his nations while assuring the minority white citizens that they would be protected from retribution following the end of apartheid. He said the burden of the past lies heavily on all those who inflicted injury and those who suffered. In Washington, officials from Doctors Without Borders, the French non-governmental organization, met today with State Department and congressional leaders to discuss the situation in Sudan. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
About 500,000 people in the southern Sudan could starve to death unless a humanitarian airlift in neighboring Kenya can be restored. That's what Philippe Biberson, the president of Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, told State Department officials and congressional leaders today. He said at least 20,000 tons of food are now sitting in United Nations warehouses in northern Kenya. They have not been delivered to the Sudan because the Kenyan government is demanding fees for re-registering relief planes, and additional flights for the airlift have not been arranged. Clinton administration officials said they would work with relief groups to resolve the problem before the onset of the rainy season in southern Sudan within 3 weeks, when torrential rains will make deliveries at some airstrips impossible. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
You can now own for your very own 57 minutes worth of tape recordings purporting to be phone conversations between President Clinton and Jennifer Flowers, the woman who claimed to have had a 12-year love affair with him before he became president. Flowers is releasing the tapes herself. She says she wants to set the record straight, that she was never the kind of woman the Clinton people would have you believe. She set up a toll-free number for mail-order sales. They're $19.95 plus shipping and handling. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new gold rush out west, and it's behind the latest controversy over the use of our public lands. This is the subject of a Frontline documentary that will be shown tonight on public television. My guest is correspondent Robert Krolwich. Over 3 million acres of federal lands are now in the hands of private mining companies. Under an 1872 law, mining companies get cheap access to the land and don't have to pay any royalties to the government for the precious metals they extract. The issue of royalties is now before Congress, and it's pitted Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt against the mining industry. Last week, Babbitt reluctantly, under court order, transferred nearly 2,000 acres of federal land in Nevada to a Canadian mining company, American Barrick Resources. The company paid less than $10,000 for title to this land, which has an estimated $10 billion of gold. A federal judge ruled that this land belonged to the mining company under the 1872 Mining Act.
The act was created under President Ulysses Grant, and it was an unapologetic attempt to woo people from the crowded East into the empty West. And so it was, look, if you guys or ladies or family people come out here to the West, you too can be rich. We've set up a law that would encourage you to look around for silver or gold. Then, if you think you might find some, we'll let you lay claim very simply to the land. And if you then start digging holes and actually find something, we will let you, A, take the land from the people of the United States and make it yours for your family and your heirs and your assigns forever. That is, we will let you privatize public land for the purpose of mining. And B, when you take gold or silver out of the land, we will not charge you any royalty. It'll be all your gold. So come on out here and dig. That was the original impulse.
Well, why is this 1872 Mining Act still on the books, considering how much has changed in the American West and in America in general since the 1800s?
The miners, like the loggers and the ranchers, have political allies. And in this case, it's generally the congressional delegations from the Western states have been consistent for the last 80 years in making sure that any attempt by the U.S. Congress, and the attempts have been numerous and some of them ancient, you know, in the 1920s and in the 30s and the 50s and 60s, again in the 70s with Cecil Andrews, people tried to change the law. But the senators and congressional delegations from those regions said, no, let's let the situation lie as is. And they were able to get enough support on other issues to keep any president of the United States, Nixon, Carter, right up to the present one, from changing the rules in any significant way.
In the meantime, there's something of a new gold rush happening now out west.
Yeah. A couple of things happened. First of all, the idea that most people have about gold mining, which is that, you know, once upon a time there were tunnels and you'd go to a river with a pan and you'd shake the pan and little nuggets would show up. I think most people figure that that's probably not the way big companies do it anymore. Probably people, like myself anyway, thought, well, what they'll do is they'll go into a mine, dig a hole, a channel into the mine and find some vein of gold in there and then probably get some robot or something to go in and take it out. That's what I thought. I was quite surprised by what actually happens. A few years ago, scientists, geologists discovered that there is gold in tiny, tiny concentrations, which can be magically segregated from regular Earth. So if you walk along in Nevada, say, and you look at a big mountain or just a big space of Earth, and it looks just has sagebrush on it, nothing in particular, and then you take a core sample and you send it to a laboratory and you see nothing. You see no stone, nothing shiny, nothing. But the microscope tells you that there's a concentration of gold in this Earth of point something or other. If it's up high enough, like 0.9 or whatever, you throw up your hat, just like old gold miners used to do. You yell Eureka, you jump up and down on the ground, of course, in a corporate sort of way, and your stock goes through the roof, as happened with American Barrick, and you're a very happy person. But still, you can't see anything. Then you dig a hole. A hole, the noun hole, does not quite do justice to what actually happens. They get trucks that are so huge that the wheels of the trucks are like 15, 16 feet tall, so that you have to reach up to touch the hubcap. And the trucks are unbelievably gigantic in how much earth they can carry. And you start to dig a hole, or take the mountain down, and then dig a hole underneath the mountain. And you move the mountain to large platforms, and then you spread earth, which is just normal, grungy, old earth with some vegetables and worms in it. And then you spread hoses across the top of the earth, and then you take a solution, which is a cyanide solution, and you drip it over the earth. And magically, you have a little liner down at the bottom. The cyanide solution percolates through the earth and attracts the gold, the tiny, tiny flakes of gold. And that all gathers on the lining, and you've got some mud at the bottom of the lining. It still doesn't look like gold, but then you put it in a large mill and you clean it, and in the end, it comes out as sparkling gold.
Well, you asked what I thought was a very clever question to a mining executive. You said, how much earth would you have to mine to get enough gold for your wedding ring? What did the guy tell
you? Yeah, he said that the trucks were going by. And again, imagine a truck bigger than any truck you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a monster truck. It's going by. And that would not give me a fraction. All of the earth in there melted down to the gold would not give me a fraction of my wedding ring, which would seem to me hard to understand why this is a profitable business. However, the cost of the truck is huge, but the value of the gold is significant enough and has risen enough to justify the whole enterprise, more than justify, to make it quite a profitable enterprise. It's astonishing, really. I mean, if you're standing there and seeing something that big go by with less gold than is in a little piece of your ring, you think, this cannot be.
My guest is Robert Krulwich, correspondent for tonight's PBS Frontline documentary on the private use of public lands. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Robert Krulwich. One of the assumptions here is that mining public land for gold is a good thing for the country.
Yeah.
Because if it weren't a good thing for the country, then the government wouldn't be endorsing a policy that encouraged people to take public land and mine it.
Hmm.
What lies behind that assumption that mining public lands is good for the country?
Well, the assumption is the ancient assumption that we started with, the 120-year-old assumption, that the best thing about that's good for mining in the country is it brings people out west to settle the West. We don't really have that problem anymore.
Right.
The second assumption is a Bruce Babbitt assumption, which I think turned out equally false. He believed a few years ago that when he became the Interior Secretary, he would like wander around, say, in his mind anyway, a place like Las Vegas, and he'd say, well, who's here? Are these raw Westerners? No, a lot of them are Angelenos or people who come down from Salt Lake City or from Chicago who are croupiers and restaurant managers and golf landscape artists or whatever. And sure, they're Westerners now. Sure, they wear cowboy hats and cowboy boots. Sure, they are suspicious of Washington, like all good Westerners are. But do they really love miners? Do they really imagine themselves ranchers or loggers? Or could it be that really what they are environmentalists waiting to express themselves? And Bruce Babbitt was of the notion that if he and the President of the United States took a firm stand on timber and grazing and mining, that they would get a surprising amount of vocal support from Westerners all over the West, from Denverites, Las Veganites, Renoites, Boiseites, and so on. And that loud clamor of applause from all the people who want to spend the weekend hunting in the woods would scare the Western senators.
Did that happen? That's what he thought.
No way. Didn't happen. And it's a puzzle, I think, to both the environmentalists and to Bruce Babbitt. This new West, it's probably there. But what actually happened was when the timber issue came up and then the grazing issue, the people who felt their jobs were threatened, of course, went quickly into action and went back to the senators and the congressmen who were their friends and said, help us, and here's some money for your campaigns, and help us, help us, help us. And then the Babbitt side went to the environmental, to the quiet community and said, help us, and they didn't get much support. And the Western senators got traditional support, and the Western senators whooped Mr. Babbitt and whooped the president. They had a filibuster on grazing, which was quite successful. They beat back the various approaches that the early approaches that the administration had on those first two issues, and they're going to try to do the same thing here. Somehow or other, Bruce Babbitt has not yet been able to build the groundswell support. And of course, when he wasn't able to build it, the president of the United States, a very political animal, was just a wee bit worried about how this would affect more important priorities, the budget, health care, and the votes of those critical senators. He didn't want to offend them for his own reasons, and so Bruce Babbitt became, in several times in this story, a very isolated figure, with everybody bopping him and nobody holding his hand.
Mm-hmm. You know, part of the argument that the mining industry is making is, look, you need these jobs. You don't want to take these jobs away from people. Mm-hmm. But how many jobs are there now in the mining industry? From the way you described it before, it seems that a lot of the mining industry has become pretty automated.
There aren't that many jobs. And the companies that run, the headquarters of these companies are often in Canada and not in the United States. So they have a big problem. They don't have a lot of people who take, at least who work specifically for mining companies. Like any good lobbying organization, they point out that miners, A, use equipment, so you add in the equipment companies. That they drive trucks, so you add in the truck companies. That they eat lunch, so you add in all the lunch companies. That they live in houses, so you add in the lumber companies and the construction companies. So you can build the case that this is a big industry with lots of jobs attached. But in the pristine sense of how many people go to work as miners or mining supervisors, it is a very small group. And that's compounded by the fact that many of these companies are run by foreign executives. So it's harder. They have a hard time. What is interesting to me, though, since this was the weakest link of the three, timber and grazing and mining, they are going into this battle willing to compromise, quite willing to pay some royalty, and quite willing to agree not to have to get the land for $2.50 or $5 anymore. But they're going into it more confidently than you would imagine, because they have noticed that when people, even a small group of people, find their jobs in jeopardy, they get the attention of their politicians. And governors and senators are alerted to their plight, and without any countervailing pressure from the broad swath of other people in the West, President Clinton, because he is a minority president, elected by a minority of the voters, and because he is very anxious to push agendas that would require the votes of these senators, is in a very weak position. And that's what gives them courage, Bill Clinton's weakness.
I think all the public land issues, as important as they are, they're not sexy issues to cover.
No.
And I think it's Dale Bumpers, the Arkansas senator who's been trying to reform the 1872 law, who mm-hmm. was talking to you in your documentary about the difficulty that he's had in interesting the media in this issue at all. Why did you take this on?
Oh, because I was real interested in Bruce Babbitt. Like everybody, I think I found holes in the ground kind of boring until I saw the holes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, like a boy with trucks, I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I just wanted to call up my son and say, Jesse, you've got to come here immediately because you have never seen anything like this. And I doubt whether my wife or my daughter, Nora, would be as interested. But there is a Boys in Trucks thing. And then there is the underlying tale, which is actually a good tale. I mean, even a fun tale. Which is called What Happens to This Region of the United States Now as It Begins to Fill Up? Mm-hmm. National Geographic did a neat job, I thought, when they took a valley in Idaho. And they looked up the valley, and up on the top of the valley there was a mine. And behind the mine there was some grazing cattle. And then down a bit were bunches of people riding skidoos in a skidoo trail of some kind. And then there was a river that was flowing along, and that had rafting people. And then kind of in the middle there was more cattle people and a couple of condo owners who were thinking of building a casino above a slag heap, and then down from them were some Hollywood people who had bought large ranches and didn't want the condo people building near them, didn't want the trail bike people. Then some hiking and fishing people were coming through up and down this group, up and down this territory in the summer. Here you've got a place that used to be empty, and now you've got all of these people bumping into each other. And this mining story, the logging story, and the ranching story is all a piece of that. But this is a space that is filling up, and Americans once again have to figure out by what rules and by what standards they will organize themselves and what are our priorities. And what's wonderfully interesting, somewhat stirring to me about Bruce Babbitt's attempt, as tough and as fruitless as it has been thus far, is to see a man who believes that you can get people to be reasonable and charitable in a situation which does not invite, oftentimes, either reason or charity. He believes that people will resolve this from down below.
Robert Krulwich, thank you a lot for talking with us.
Sure.
Robert Krulwich is the correspondent for the Frontline documentary, Public Lands, Private Profits. It will be shown tonight on PBS. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The defendants in the World Trade Center bombing sentenced today in New York. The Justice Department announces a settlement with the Denny's restaurant chain. The company denies that Denny's has had a policy of discrimination against African Americans, but agrees to a settlement of $46 million. Nelson Mandela's State of the Union address in South Africa. He talks about his social goals and also appeals to outside countries to invest in South Africa. And a story from California about a community that's trying to decide if it indeed wants a new state prison.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the big concerns about the so-called information superhighway is who's going to have access to it. One person who's thinking about the issue is writer Jim Northrup. He lives on the Fond du Lac Reservation in northern Minnesota. Northrup is Anishinaabe, also known as Chippewa. He follows Anishinaabe traditions while he's wild ricing and collecting maple sap for syrup, but he also writes on a computer.
We need to put our electronic moccasin tracks on the information superhighway. There's a revolution going on, and if we don't join, we'll be left in the dust. I remember the words of Crow Chief Plenty Coos. With education, you are the white man's equal. Without it, you're the white man's victim. Computers are in use in reservation schools, the casinos, and administrative offices. My dream is to see that every Indian home on the Fond du Lac Reservation has a computer. Not only a computer, but access to information networks. We could advise the decision makers on major issues. Say, for example, the reservation wanted to sell treaty rights to the state of Minnesota. The people affected could let their leaders know how they feel by typing in answers on an opinion survey. The leaders could explain the reasons for wanting to sell. Maybe reservation leaders want to get in a casino deal with the city of Duluth. The people could be heard on the idea. It would be true democracy instead of the way we do it now. We could vote on every important issue. The Anishinaabe could become computer literate in one generation. We'd be doing a better job of preparing our children for their future. Anishinaabe have a long history of adopting new technologies. The gun replaced the bow for taking food. Steel knives last longer than stone ones. Telephones have made the reservation gossip system, what we call the moccasin telegraph, work faster. Today we play more blackjack than cribbage. There are schools that use an interactive computer to teach the Ojibwe language. I think the Anishinaabe of this reservation would use that particular program. We know one good way to preserve the language is to use it. The children who are already using computers in school could teach their elders. We could have an encyclopedia disc in every home. The interaction between the generations would add strength to the families. The computers could be used to play video games. That'd be a plus when the wind chill is 75 below zero. Once on the superhighway, the people could share information with others around the world. There's a thirst for information about the Anishinaabe. I know, because of all the questions people ask as I travel off the reservation. Maintaining the system would create jobs. We'd need technicians and librarians, technocrats rather than bureaucrats. Of course, there are obstacles to every dream. The first is the cost to get everyone on the superhighway. One way would be to use a small part of the casino profits to pay for it. That'd be an easy way to demonstrate to the federal government that we're using the gambling profits wisely. The Anishinaabe could use community service to show their willingness to earn access to the information superhighway. Volunteer hours could be exchanged for hardware, software, and access. If the people can earn the computer through labor, they'll take care of it. The technology is there. We just need to make it available to the people. We can't afford to be hitchhikers on the information superhighway.
Jim Northrup lives on the Fond du Lac Reservation in northern Minnesota. His book, Walking the Res Road, won a 1994 Minnesota Book Award. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlease, Sue Spolin, and Jewel Bracey. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1977, Gary Gilmore became the first American executed in over 10 years. On the next Fresh Air, his brother Michael Gilmore investigates his family history to understand why Gary became a murderer and why Michael escaped the family's violent legacy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.